Good afternoon. Welcome to The Journey 8. I'm your host, Reverend Judy Hosner, and I invite you to sit back and take a few moments to breathe as we share this journey together.
Well, here we are. And it must be Tuesday because I'm on the internet. And good afternoon. I hope your day is going well. And we're going to have a great show today, I think. We'll start off with little old me and the book of Ecclesiastes. And then we're going to have a nice gentleman on by the name of Robert Kopecky, who's going to talk to us about life after death and how to survive. And I think I read his book. It's very interesting. So we'll talk to him in the second half. So let's get our announcements out of the way. And, of course, the first one is still, and I'm going to keep bugging you until I see something on the tally board at GoFundMe.com. for Jen Phipps' Quisenberry's trip to Mozambique, Africa. And that's going to take place in October. Missionary trip to a orphanage in Mozambique. So please help me see that tally board start moving. And if you go to my website, www.closerwalkwithyou.com, you'll find all the information for the GoFundMe, or you can go to GoFundMe's website and just put in Jen Phipps, P-H-I-P-P-S, and you'll go right to her her donation site. Okay, now, an update on the Bible trivia game. And boy, did I put myself in a tither this week, not realizing that creating a game on a website with a Mac is fun, but wasn't quite what I wanted. So I found a outside website for us to use for our trivia game, and I have it all set up. It's ready to go. And you're going to go to a website called Sure. Worked on it until the wee hours this morning, purposegames.com. And purposegames.com does nothing but help you set up challenges and trivia games and so on and so forth. So if you go to their homepage and you click on the Explore button at the top of the page, and then it says Tournaments, you will find the Journey 8's quiz for this week. And every week I'll update it, and that site keeps track of who answers the questions the most accurately and does all the hard work that I was trying to do myself, which leaves me free to play the games. No. So anyway, go over to PurposeGames.com, and you will find the Journey 8's tournament to quiz for this week, and it will go from today until next Tuesday, and we'll switch it. Okay, if you have any problems or questions, you can reach me by email at jhosner@closerwalkwithyou.com. Or go to the Closer Walk With You webpage, and I wrote the instructions out there also. One last thing before we get started, and that is, I never hear from any of you. Is there anybody out there? Is there life out there? Or am I in a different dimension and you can't hear me? If you're out there and you have a question, or just want to say hi, that's fine. The call-in number here, which I have not been very good about giving you lately, is area code 888 627-6008. And I will try and answer a question for you or just say hi or something. In the meantime, we'll get down to business because Mr. Kopecky will be waiting for us soon. So today, I thought, and that's always a dangerous thing, but I did think that I wanted to bring to you a lesson that I did a while back on a different radio station, and I thought I wanted it here. I wanted you to hear it. For those of you who followed me from yonder, you can sit and listen to this again, and who knows, you might pick up something new. So the title of today's lesson is God's in Charge. Now, we might not think that sometimes, but it is true. And for those of us who are headstrong, we sometimes don't want to think that God's in charge, that we've got it covered. So I'm here, and sometimes it's the job of a preacher, teacher, whatever you want to think of me as, to give you guidance and to remind you who we are and who God is. Well, God is God. Okay, so you don't need me anymore. No. So we're going to go over to the book of Ecclesiastes, one of my favorite books of the Bible, chapter 5, verse 1 through 7. And I'm going to do something a little different today. We're going to read this. I'm going to read it to you from the NIV version of the Bible, which is basically the one I use. And then what you're going to hear as a message is the Hosner edited or annotated version of these seven chapters. Hopefully it all comes together for you and makes some sense. So before I start to read the scripture passage, remember my disclaimer. No truck drivers, pilots, crane operators, taxi drivers, or tightrope walkers should reach for your Bible and read along with me right now. Save it until you get home tonight. And just trust that I'm going to read it to you correctly for the moment. And the rest of you, pull out your iPhones, your iPads, your Kindles, your Nooks, and maybe even an old-fashioned Bible and follow along with me as we go to Ecclesiastes 5, verses 1 through 7. Here we go. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Go near and listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who don't know what they are doing is wrong. Do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven, and you are on earth, so let your words be few. A dream comes when there are many cares, and many words mark the speech of a fool. When you make a vow to God, do not delay in fulfilling it. Yeah, I like that. Do not delay in fulfilling it. It is better not to make a vow than to make one and not fulfill it. Do not let your mouth lead you into sin, and do not protest to the temple messenger, "My vow was a mistake." Why? Let's see. Why my iPad is not working? No. Do not protest to the temple messenger, "My vow is a mistake." Why should God be angry at what you say and destroy the work of your hands? Much dreaming and many words are meaningless. Therefore, fear God. Now, the interesting thing is the word fear, when used 9 times out of 10 in the Bible, means respect. It doesn't mean like trembling, I'm afraid, you know, sore afraid. It can, but more often than not, it does not mean that. So fear God means respect God. So that is the NIV version. So we're going to take a little walk on the Hosner side, as they say, and let's go. God's in charge. When I was a child, I always believed that my ticket out of being poor with hand-me-downs to wear was going to be the magic of the Good Things Fairy. Yes, that make-believe little wing fairy that came just to fix my not-so-perfect life. When you are young, we dream many dreams, and some come true and some do not. So I'd straighten up my back a little stiffer, be a little angrier, and commit myself to perfection, even more than the last disappointment. I would be in charge of my destiny, and no one would knock me down again. Sound familiar to any of you out there? Well, then we grow up and reality hits. There is no fairy, but there is a God. And through the years, I've come to know that I'm not really in charge of much. My life is in his hands, and like it or not, he is the creator, and I am the created. Now, does that mean we are not in charge of anything? I thought we'd take a look at some of the things we are in charge of and how God expects us to be careful with them. The book of Ecclesiastes is thought by some to be written by King Solomon. In fact, when I was in seminary, I had some fellow students that swore it was written by King Solomon. Although much of it sounds like Solomon and something he would write, the actual writer identifies himself as the teacher. And he refers to himself in a generic way, you know, and to today is really unknown. No matter who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, it's filled with wisdom, and I like studying it. Most of the time. So it's basically written in the third person, sort of like a person looking in the window of a restaurant watching people eat and recording what they're doing. It's autobiographical, which means he's really kind of reflecting on his own life and taking it one step further and saying, what is the meaning of life? I think this is the original place where that saying came from. So we're going to review the scripture passage for today's lessons, and we're going to put it in my language. Here we go. Hang on. We'll tackle it verse by verse. Here we go. Verse 1. Well, the writer here wastes no time throwing the first punch. Very intently, he says, hey, when you enter God's house, do so with humility and reverence, with the focus on learning and not just putting an offering in the plate and reading your email the rest of the time or playing Angry Birds. God's house is a place of worship and learning, requiring your full attention to be there completely in the moment. You know, Facebook and email can wait for an hour. Really. I mean, really, they can. And if anyone knew me personally, they'd know that that's really a silly statement for me to make, but it's not silly. You know, when you go into a temple or a church or mosque or whatever your belief is, put the toys away and listen. You might actually learn something. Verse 2. Maybe verse 2 is probably you've heard this from your parents in some way, shape, or form. In every situation, church or not, don't speak before you think. In other words, do not engage your tongue before your brain. Don't just say things you think God would be happy to hear from you. And oh, he'll love you oh so much if you say this. Instead, and I always tell everyone that I counsel with, speak from your heart. Or don't speak at all. Remember, God already knows what's happening with you anyway. That's why he's God and you, you're. I mean, he knows exactly what's in your heart. So why should we even bother praying if he already knows? Why should we talk to him? He already knows what's happening. Well, here's the deal. Here's my take on it. I believe when you speak those words lying deep inside of you, you've done for yourself what God has wanted. Releasing pain, anger, sadness, whatever inside that needs to come out. When you speak the words in your heart, you're being your own therapist in a way. God wants to hear, even if he does know, he wants to hear it from the horse's mouth. I guess that's the right end. So there is a reason why we pray. When we partition God, it's for us, not for him. He already knows what we're going to say. Speak the words of your hearts and then wait and listen, because he might want to answer you. And if you're busy talking, who knows? You might miss the answer. And he will answer, maybe not in the 3 seconds that you've snapped your fingers and asked for it, or not in the way that you wanted to, but things work together. They all work together for the end product of good. And when they don't, it's usually because we've gotten in the way. And we've taken back something that should have stayed on the other side. So verse 2, short and sweet, do not engage your tongue before your brain. Yeah. Verse 3 is even more fun. Boy, howdy. Here we go. Now, I think that verse 3 goes something like this, and I apologize up front to any of my friends who might be listening, who think I am targeting them, because I am not. I just get the words, I'm just the conduit, remember that. God gave it to me and I'm saying it. If you're one of the up and moving employees working 12 or 14 hours a day, reevaluate what you get for your money. Okay? First of all, if you're on salary and you're working 14 hours a day, you've just lowered your value because you're not making $80 an hour. I don't know if anybody that makes $80 an hour. Maybe. Okay, so the deal here is that if you reevaluate what you get for your money, you'll find you get increased health problems, anxiety, less time to live your life. You know, if you got a family, whatever that family unit looks like, and you're at work 14 hours a day and you come home in time to eat and take a shower and go to bed, you don't have a family. You have people who belong in the same house as you. You know, the older I've gotten, the more I've realized, and I know a lot of people say this, that time is valuable and you cannot replace it. So, you know, reevaluate. And you know, God puts us here to learn to love as he did. Learn to be a good neighbor. Can't be a good neighbor if you're not there, if you're not a neighbor. And above all, take care of you. You can't take care of anyone else but you. You can't make anyone else do anything. You might think you can. But your only control is yourself. And if you don't take care of yourself, nobody else is going to. You know, your loved ones might sit by your bedside while you're, you know, hanging on to life. But your responsibility is to take care of you. And as the passage says, overwork deprives you of the rest, and overtalk shows you are not listening to God. So Are you any smarter than God? I don't think so. Take the time to smell the roses. And if you don't like roses, smell pansies. I don't know if they have the smell. But I like that saying anyway. So, you know, we get really tied up in being successful. And I know that I'm a pot calling the kettle black in my working years. It was not uncommon for me to work 100 hours a week. And it got me early retirement. So, you know, there's a cause and effect for everything. Anybody who's a scientist that's listening to me knows. Cause and effect. So, you know, bodies are mechanical things and they break down. Verse 4 and 5 go together. I just kind of smooshed them together. That's the neat thing about writing the Hausner annotated version of the Bible. You can smoosh. So these two verses go hand in hand, and they kind of complement verse 3. The writer basically is saying that it's your responsibility to ask for clarity. So, you know, when you're sitting down and having a beer and talking to God about whatever is on your mind, and you feel like you're being called to do something, or you're being torn about a decision you have to make, ask for clarity. It doesn't mean that he's going to say, gee, okay, Sam, I'll just give this one to Sally and find another task for you. Because it seems like, you know, you're uncomfortable with this. Well, you can just believe that the answer is not. So your choice is to get it straight with God before you go and say you're going to do it. And I'm basically talking not so much, you know, in the, you know, go out and be a preacher kind of thing. Or I'm talking about everyday stuff that you feel like, oh, you know what? I really feel like we need to add 17 more computers and 25 more people. And your partner's tearing their hair out, saying, are you out of your mind? And you're saying, but I'm really feeling like this is a need. Sit down, talk it over. Yeah, you don't have to be in some kind of big fancy chapel with gold inlay, anything. You know, there's no need for that. I mean, they're nice, don't get me wrong. I like church. I go to church. I thought it would be nice in some of Reverend to show up every once in a while. So, you know, ask for clarity. Don't be afraid. And then shut up and let them tell you. Well, I guess that's a little blunt. Okay, be quiet and listen for that still small voice to tell you what's going on. Okay? And the last part of this chapter, yeah, verse 6 and 7, probably my favorite part of it. In the end, the writer is saying, don't let your mouth make a sinner of you. You know, don't go around saying things that you can do that you can't. Don't make false statements, you know, about stuff. God's not very pleased with that. And usually it does nothing but damage you. Because eventually, if you keep talking about things you can do that you can't, it comes back and bites you in the donkey. You know, empty talk, empty actions, and empty vows only make for an empty and painful relationship with God and with your family. You know, one of the things I've watched over the years, and it's unfortunate, is people who have a tendency to be the big shot, as I call them, and the overbearing, the overstated, person that wants to be everything to everybody and ends up being a very lonesome person in the end. Because people see through that. And if you and I, as fallible as we are, can see through it, then I'm thinking that God sees through it. You know, God is the cornerstone, is the rock, so they say. The foundation, the Alpha, the Omega. If you give him the respect of his place in the universe, yeah, he's going to stand by you and things are going to be okay. It might be a little rough. I've probably had one of the roughest weeks this week. But you know what? It all comes out in the end. And things, you know, kind of sift through. And before you know it, you're on the sunny side of the street, so they say in the song. So very wise words from an unknown person. Someone who doesn't really identify himself. And someone who is so much wisdom about life here. But as you read through Ecclesiastes, you found that the wisdom kind of stops here on earth. He doesn't quite tie it in with the God thing too much. So that's the job of those of us who interpret and teach you. The idea is there, and I think it's a good one. I think that as you go through Ecclesiastes, and that's, of course, where you find the to everything there's a season, and a few other things that have been made into songs, you'd be okay if you read that at least, you know, once a year and kept your head squared on. So that's it. I think that was quite painless, don't you? The Hosner annotated version of the Bible, spoken in my true slangy kind of self. And I think we have Mr. Kopecky on the line, so we're going to go to him because I want him to tell us, kind of along the lines of what we just talked about, he's going to talk to us about life and death. Are you there, Robert?
Yes, I am. Hi, Judy. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming on board. I'm going to start out with a short introduction. This is Mr. Robert Kopecky, who has written a book, How to Survive Life and Death. And I totally enjoyed reading it last few nights. And why don't you start by telling me how, in a short form, you came about writing this book?
Well, it's a long story. As they say, I'm 57 years old. A few years ago, I didn't imagine myself to be a published writer. And in fact, I had a blog online for my animation art because I'm a professional animation designer. And I started to post spiritual blogs on it, and they started becoming kind of more popular than the art that I had up. And, you know, over the course of my life, I had these three near-death experiences that really crystallized for me when I took up a spiritual path and began meditating and doing service and doing some writing. That all started about 10 years ago, 10 or 12 years ago now. And it really was in sitting in meditation that it just arose, that the inspiration to write this book just kind of arose. And I have a little house on the Upper Delaware River in Pennsylvania that's very pretty and very quiet, calm. And I had an opportunity to sit there for about 2 or 3 weeks and kind of knocked out the first draft of it and got some encouragement. And a couple of years later, then after about 5 or 6 drafts, it was published as you experienced it the last couple nights, I guess, huh?
Yes. Yes. So, near-death experience. What's is there any kind of common thread that runs in that? You know, you see all these TV shows about people who've had near deaths, and who am I to say whether they do or don't? And you hear the tunnel and the lights and the. Did any of that happen with you?
You know, a lot of that particular one, the rather famous journey through the tunnel towards the light, did not happen to me. And there are a lot of common sort of formats for near-death experiences, that one included. And the three that I had do sort of fall into categories. They do fall into categories, just not that particular one in this case. I had my first near-death experience was the rather classic out-of-body experience where I witnessed the whole scene of the car accident I was involved in from about 20 or 30 feet up in the air, more or less, and was able to look over hedges into people's yards and see things that when I came back to check out were in the places where I had seen them when I was in that position up above everything. I couldn't communicate to anyone, even though I tried. I witnessed my body being put into an ambulance and taken away. And in that experience, then I was kind of shepherded off. I was never alone, but I never knew exactly who I was with. I didn't turn and confront the person, so to speak. But in that experience, I ended up having kind of a long discussion in kind of a pastoral place, which I can only imagine was about the things that I had to do or I had done, perhaps. Then I regained consciousness. It was about 18 or 20 hours, the whole thing. So that was a classic one. And my second near-death experience was classic in the sense that I saw scenes from my life. I was shown scenes from my life and not the greatest hits. It wasn't. They weren't the golden moments of Bob, you know. They were more like those kinds of moments when you could have learned something important, but perhaps you didn't, or perhaps I didn't. I'll put it in the first person, and that taught me that that there is this kind of accounting there, that time is a completely different thing than the way we experience it here. That there are these kind of discrete panes of eternal time that record our lives. And I imagine then are stacked up in such a way to mean something in the world beyond this, or the world before this, or the continuum that we, I believe, exist in, you know. And the third one was basically I had the experience of not wanting to leave. I wanted to stay there, and I was rather gently forced back into this life. Because I hadn't exited the right way, and I had things that I had left to do. So in that sense, I had three very typical and sort of, you might almost say at this point, commonplace near-death experiences. But they seemed pretty unique to me at the time.
Just going to say, for anybody who's experiencing them, they're unique, you know. I'm just amazed that you had three. I've heard of people having one, you know, and their stories have, you know, changed a little bit. You know, one person sees the light, some sees, you know, different things. But three, I was just taken back when I saw your bio. I said, I got to talk to this guy. He's got the market. He's got the corner on the market of... going and coming, shall we say.
There's a couple other famous three-timers. Not that I'm particularly famous, but there are a couple of people that are really well-known. I didn't really know about them. I didn't investigate the whole near-death experience thing before I wrote this book, and I've only come to learn more about it now, as a result of having written the book. But it is pretty fascinating how many people there are who have had them. I mean, literally, thousands and thousands of people that are documented, their experiences are documented. And, you know, like you said, so many people who that you may know yourself who've had one,
mm-hmm.
maybe, you know, I don't recommend having three. It wasn't my plan, you know. Not having one was, you know, my plan at all, and the plans at all. And in fact, you know, I didn't have that experience of death that I will have as I get older, which is to possibly to, you know, become sick and slowly die. These were occasions that were totally unexpected. I, you know, they just happened, and I found myself consciously in this other place, in this other existence that was very effortless, light, you know, without gravity, without the incessant demands of serial thinking. I felt my mind felt very holistic. I felt very welcome and very comfortable in it. And so the one thing that I have to report to people that I hope for those who are worried about it that might ease their mind is that it's just as easy as stepping from one room to another. And in my experiences, the only thing that was terrifying about them may have been just the immediate situation, but almost as immediately, they were just amazing and peaceful and wonderful. And so there is, you know, nothing to worry about. I'm here to report.
When I was reading through the book, you have a connection, and there's been several theologians that I've worked with that truly, truly believe in reincarnation. How does that tie in, or is there really a continuum, do you believe?
Well, my experience has helped me to understand this concept of the eternal, you know, where the eternal is not a never-ending space of time, but a aspect of time that exists in every moment, you know, that's right at this very moment, we are living this in eternal time, right? And mm-hmm. my experience of my near-death experiences really informed that very powerfully for me. So as I learned or, you know, have come to believe that consciousness continues seamlessly from one life to the next, whether it's extra-dimensional or I'm not exactly sure of the structure of it, I am quite certain that I at least live beyond this life. And so presumably, you know, given how many things seem to be so resolved for so many people when they enter this life, that that there has been something before. And you know how many things I, for one, have left to resolve on my way out. You know, I will continue on into another life. And I also think that there's an awful lot of evidence for these kinds of things that's documented and that is just as empirical as you could ever want it to be, but it doesn't really measure up to the standards of science because it is not scientific. It's an investigation of the soul, which is not a scientific thing. You know, and when you hear about kids, you know about children that are able to write concerts, you know, orchestrated concerts when they're 5 years old or something. Now, did they really learn all that between 1 and 5? You know, I can't believe it. And there are lots of instances, and one that I talk about in the book too, of people who are able to give factual information about things they couldn't possibly have known about that were in a whole different era, you know. So,
right.
Yeah, I believe wholeheartedly in reincarnation or in a continuum, that we're part of a continuum of life, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's where people get the deja vu kind of feeling. And for me, it's mostly scents. You know, I smell something, and it's like, whoa, you know, you almost have that where you're stepping back somewhere that you've never been, that you, as today, have never been, but yet it's a familiar thing.
Right.
You know, and I try to balance that, of course, with my religious, outlook and stuff. And it's just, eternity is eternity, and how we know it today, might not be anything close to how we are going to know it at some point.
Well, yeah, we know it through this. You're mentioning what your senses have to do with the recollection, the return to places you've never been before, We are sensory creatures. That's what this experience on this world is about. I believe that we are here to experience only what you can experience by being a human being. And my sense of life, after this one, is that it's a different thing. It's a different format, And people, people have such varying descriptions of their near-death experiences, of the afterlife scenarios. They can be very grand, some of them, and spectacular, and others can be, rather humble. Mine are pretty small, comparatively. But to me, that indicates that there is this continuing potential of imagination on an individual level that... that we know how powerful it can be in this life, that maybe when we lose the constraints of this particular physical form becomes even more incredibly powerful, So,
did you have wings?
I don't know if I had wings. I never turned around to check. I don't believe I did in my last one. My last one I was pretty jaded, and I hadn't really learned enough from my first two to really turn my life around, and I was still kind of heading for my final dark night of the soul, so to speak.
Yes.
And it was an act of violence where I was assaulted by a skinhead, and I responded violently, and I didn't know that there was a group of skinheads that had seen me in an altercation with one of their friends, and later they came up behind me and knocked me unconscious with something hard and stomped and kicked me for a long time.
Mm.
And it was my experience on the other side, so to speak, was pretty dark, kind of. It wasn't as celestial as my previous two had been. It's an interesting aspect of it, too, that comes out of what I've learned is that I seem to be able in this life, and I think that everybody is, capable of recognizing how heavenly everything can be here at any given moment. Even sometimes the things that aren't particularly interesting to you one minute, if you change the way that you experience them, can become... is positively captivating and miraculous,
Well, that's partly due to the way that we as individuals are capable of changing. A change always brings, a different perspective. And
right.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we all thought of having a, especially in these days, a heavenly kind of experience here. It's not so heavenly right at the moment, but we find our pieces of heaven as we go along. One of the things you wrote in your book, and I'm going to read it. It's over in the Wear What You've Got On chapter. And it says, if your life's been based on being impressive and how many people you are, and how much valuable stuff you've managed to accumulate, then you could be in for some complications. And it goes on, and I'm just thinking to myself, there's about 87 Bible verses I could attach onto that.
Right. Well, you can't take it with you, right? But you do. And I'll tell you what I mean by that is that you can't take the red Corvette with you, but you can take that part of yourself that is so tied to having been able to get a red Corvette and what it meant to your image in such a way that I believe that that has something to do with the reincarnation that we were talking about, that, there is a different kind of success that we are meant to define in this life that will liberate us to a greater potential after this life. That's what I believe. And I know this, too, because of the evidence in my life, the people that I've met who have been showing me how to do it right all along, but I never noticed because they were so humble, you know? I didn't associate for many years. I didn't associate humility with success. But now I do. You know, that's the transformation that happened to me, is that I can see that everything of great, lasting beauty and real value can come out of that real, profound humility, and that most things that are problematic in this world come out of ego, the quest for power, the desire for objects and for, you know, material wealth, that kind of thing. It's not a new idea, but I'm just here to echo it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and echoing is a good thing nowadays, because I wish it was echoed more often in more different ways. You know, you take a look at the life of Jesus or Muhammad or, you know, any spiritual person, and, you know, the first thing you notice about their demeanor, their nature, is humility. They're humble. They're not red Corvettes, you know? And I think there's some power in that. And we as human beings don't seem to get it.
Well, there's an awesome power in it, you know? When you make the two into one and you say to the mountain, move, it'll move, right? When you're able to fuse or lose that aspect of materialism and bring it into line with pure faith, with that pure humility, everything becomes possible. All kinds of miracles and synchronicities start to take place in your life, you know, and it seems so counterintuitive because we're these sensory beings who, you know, want stuff. But the more you explore it and the more you allow it in your life, the more you discover that this redefinition of success is there. That's where it really lives, is in that kind of humility rather than in the desire. And all that desire and attachment, as the Buddhists would say.
So how do you turn it around? How do you take, in other words, say, for instance, you have a person in your life that, you know, is the type A, go-go, gadget kind of person, and how do you help them to see that that's not what it's about?
Well, I don't think that you can push an ego around without it standing up on its haunches and fighting back, you know. I think that each person is going to have to come to that point themselves. And when you see the whole thing all of life. I'm talking about small issues here, Judy. When you see all of life as being this completely plastic thing that might occur all in the same moment, even, you know, I mean, it's really conceptual, then people living and dying, which we're all doing all the time, constantly, billions of us cycling through, you know, it's not such a big deal after all. And the fact that somebody is so involved with becoming a somebody, with becoming somebody famous or becoming somebody rich, something like that, but is injuring people on their way to getting there, the fact that they're going to have to go through it and, you know, find out what the wages of sin lead to, so to speak, themselves, and reach that kind of bottom, come to that dark night of the soul like I needed a few different times in my life in order to come out the other side and into the light, you know, that's okay. I know that I might be able to help people by giving them, you know, what I learned from my experiences. But I'm not going to be able to confront somebody who doesn't agree with me and thinks that there's a whole better way to do it and convince them otherwise of that. You know, they have their own eternity to figure this stuff out. We all do. And I believe that we all, if we consider it in our hearts, you know, there's this kind of awesome technology of the heart, you know, that's just incredibly, profoundly powerful, where you think with your heart instead of with your intellect. People get caught up in intellect, and the intellect tells them they need things, but they might know down deep that that really is not what they're looking for. What they're looking for is love, and that's the medium that the heart functions in, right?
Absolutely. And that's always a great topic of mine, both sermon-wise and counseling-wise, is to teach people to think and feel with their hearts, because your mind can always play tricks on you.
Some of the worst things I've ever done, I thought about a great deal first.
Yeah.
And some of the best solutions that have ever come to me were there all the time in my heart. You know, I knew I should have done that.
and we all come to that place, some later than others, and some kicking and screaming, and some just saying, hey, you know, this is what it's all about. And, you know, I'll be the first one to admit that I was a kicking and screaming in the early days. And then, you know, with age comes wisdom sometimes.
Right. Well, I, to borrow a Marianne Williamson book title, I believe that everybody is essentially in the act of returning to love, you know. That even people that are acting horribly, they're perpetrating great evils on the earth, are having to do so to move through that part of their existence where they come to these, where the harshest lessons, I believe, because you live by the sword and you die by the sword, that there's a great deal of misery with people that perpetrate misery on others. You know, they have to do that to eventually be able to come back and rejoin this great circle of love. That I believe love is like a quantum field. It's like a force that exists like gravity or like electromagnetism, that it's a real thing that helps to create all the things that are beautiful and valuable in life. And that if we can consciously stay in contact with it by means of our heart, usually, you know, not that you don't think your way to it too, but we often are, you know, thinking with our heart or feeling in our heart, then it will completely transform your entire life and your whole purpose for living, and allow you to live in this kind of ease and grace that that you may have only imagined before when you were thinking about everything.
So if you had one thing in closing that that you'd like to put forth with the book, and you're going to tell me where people can get the book, of course. What's the overriding thing that you really want to try and get across?
Well, I think what I just said really is that if you really try to stay connected to love, if you carry joy out in front of you, I like to call it, sometimes I'll call it compassionate consciousness. So that when you engage with everyone else, you understand that they're all going through a rather difficult thing this life, right? And so they deserve the benefit of the doubt, and that if you can engage with them with love and with kindness, you'll discover this whole alternate way of living. There's this great fabric that under this warm fabric that underlies everything, that's kind of a conspiracy of people who are kind and spreading the good word, so to speak, you know, and that's what you want to stick with and try to become yourself. And I suppose that's kind of the main, that and not to be afraid of death. I know it's hard not to be, but it's just the nature of the beast, so to speak. But it really is quite an amazing thing in my experience. I mean, of course, I didn't really do it because I'm here talking to you. I did have an experience of it, you know. And the book, How to Survive Life and Death, and then the publisher added on A Guide for Happiness in This World and Beyond, which, yes. You know, if the shoe fits, wear it, I guess. Yeah. It's available every place, at all the big places online and stuff, but you can also try to get it at your local bookstore. It's always nice to patronize them or ask them to get it for you. It's available. And I have an author page on Facebook and a blog that's called Art, Faith, and the Coco Lion, robertkopecky.blogspot.com, where I write spiritual stuff.
Good.
And I'm on Twitter and all of that stuff now.
you've got the Twitter and the Facebook and the whole gamut going, huh?
Gotta do it. Right.
Nowadays, that's about how everybody communicates, you know. It's about Twitter and Facebook, and, you know, reluctantly I move into that realm. But, there's something to be said about face-to-face, or at least voice-to-voice communications also. I'm not good at texting, and I probably won't be in the next life either. But
Right, well... It is the way things get done, so I went there very reluctantly myself, too. But it's quite amazing, because what all this technology gives us is the opportunity to really share that compassionate consciousness. It is a real thing that's alive in this world, and mm-hmm. it is much bigger and much stronger than we generally think if we just pay attention to the regular media. It's this kind of media, this technology of the heart that I'm talking about, that we can contact each other using this social media and stuff. You know, you discover how many people are really right on the same page with you. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, you know? It's getting that way. I'm learning real fast that there's this understanding, I guess. I don't know how else to put it, that, you know, religion and spirituality are not necessarily the same thing. And,
right.
You know, we're close becoming a group of beings that are losing touch with that. And I think that's sad. You know, we're losing touch with each other. So whenever I see somebody who's pulling us back to the way it should be, that's great, because I don't want us to be so animated, shall we say, or automated, that we forget how to reach one another. That's what it's all about. Well, I do thank you for being here. I hope you come back and visit with us, and I hope that that your book continues to do well. It's very well written. And an amazing story, amazing. So please come back and visit with us again. And I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you so much, Judy. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you and your audience. And I'd be happy to come back anytime. You just let me know.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye. So there you have it, Mr. Kopecky. What a wonderful story that is. I just wanted to remind you all that the trivia quiz is up on the website. Just go over to the website that I told you earlier. What was it? It was purposegames.com, and you'll find us there under tournaments. Just look for us. And have a good week.
Thank you for listening to The Journey 8. And please come back and join us again. Remember, be kind in all you do, and the kindness will come back to you. Grace and peace, Judy Hasner.